Welcome to Casa de Cambio. We are back with episode number 90 of Casa de Cambio podcast, and it is also the final episode of season 8. And I will come back later in the year, but it's been a big season. And joining me for the second time this season is Nigel Thurlow. Welcome back to the podcast, Nigel.
Well, hey, I get to be the last of the season. This is awesome.
Yep. How has your holiday period been? Because you were saying before you were in Texas and it's been not very nice.
Yeah, it's a bit cold here in Texas at the moment. We're unseasonably cold, but hopefully the winter will be short-lived and we'll be back to some warm temperatures before Hell's Kitchen comes in. We get sort of like spring and then fake summer, and then we get real spring and then real summer, and all these fake and real summers are incredibly hot. So in Celsius terms, 40 plus degrees. So, yeah. But it's been a really busy time, Christmas and New Year. I was hoping to sit down and rest, and all I did was work, and I've been working solidly in January right up until today, and I'm continuing to work. So I shouldn't complain. Given that some of our colleagues are struggling at the moment in our industry, I shouldn't complain, but it is a real busy time for me at the moment.
Yeah, and it's hard as a business owner to turn down work when it comes, when the industry can be so fickle. I personally find it really hard as well.
Years ago when I used to think about this, I'd never take time off. As a contractor, I'd never take time out. I'd try and find every possible day to work. And when companies were shutting down for those 2 weeks or so over Christmas and New Year traditionally, I would find every way to beg, borrow, or bully the client into allowing me to work during those periods, because I felt that taking time off was lost opportunity. It was opportunity cost. It was lost revenue. But as I've realized now that most of us in business ourselves should, especially independent business people and independent contractors, should consider the only work at most 42 weeks a year, maybe 44 weeks a year. And then they realize they have to take some holiday and recuperation time, and they should build that into their financial plan. And I can imagine you laughing at this, because but that's the reality. If you think you're going to work 52 weeks a year, that's a fallacy anyway. You physically can't, and you're never going to get that many weeks work out of a client. And then having worked in Europe for many years, they all take 6 to 10 weeks holiday a year in Europe anyway.
And well, I'm laughing because I'm Australian and we value our holidays too. And as a consultant myself, I bank on about 38 to 40. Because yeah, you're right. You've got your time between clients, and then you have your time that's your actual holiday or planned holidays. And you need to account for that. And you're not going to be working. And it is nice to take a break, especially when everyone else is taking a break at Christmas.
You need to take a break as well. And the beauty of being freelance is that if you plan your clients correctly and you play your cards right, you can take time off when all the kids are still in school. So therefore you're not paying those premium prices of when school's out, which is a significant saving, especially if you're doing some airline travel.
Correct. Yes, I do try to do that. And I usually take time out when I wrap up a client engagement. I try, and even if I've got another client booked, I'll try not to book the next client immediately after, because it is nice to refresh and have a little mental palate cleanse between clients. But it is good that way. Anyway, let's get on to the podcast, because I haven't even asked you the two questions I ask all people. So we're going to talk about the failure of agile, fake agile, and bullshit jobs today. But first, I would like to know, what are you currently watching, reading, and listening to?
Well, watching? I don't know. I'll come back to that one. But reading, I'm actually going through and reviewing many of the early lean texts from Toyota. I'm fortunate to have access to a lot of original inside material. So I'm going back and reviewing a lot of that, and also looking at some of the foundational books written by what we would describe as many of the true lean senseis, people like David Mann, Yamada San, and things of that nature. And I often return to this sort of core materials. People are starting to recognize that they've adopted ways of working without studying those fundamental principles. So I'm pulling from those texts in my work so I can illustrate those ideas and demonstrate that none of this is really new thinking. It's become sort of just a sales and marketing exercise by purveyors of frameworks and methodologies. And as clients and people are reaching out to me, including people in the industry, and saying, Nigel, what are we going to do? People aren't listening to this stuff anymore. So I'm pulling back from those original text, in some of the material I'm putting together to help them understand those fundamental principles, so we can at least talk to customers about that. And these agilists, so these people in the industry, have a way and a vocabulary to be able to go and say the same things, but with a deeper fundamental knowledge and understanding, so that their clients will listen to them and realize they're not just the typical certified Scrum Master rhetoric purveyors.
Purveyors of fine Scrum. No, that's good. Going back to basics, I think, is a really good idea and a good recommendation. The second question is, actually, no, I want to share a watching recommendation with the audience, because I never do. I've started watching a show, and it's on Netflix, so it's, you know, international. It's called Boy Swallows Universe. And if you want to know what it's like to be a kid growing up in suburban Australia in the 1980s, that is the show. And I'm too, and I started watching it, and I wanted to stay up all night watching it. And I was like, go to bed, Tash, because I had to get up early and do this interview. I was like, you can't be tired. You need to go to sleep. And it was one of those. And I actually woke up, and I can't wait for the day to end so I can watch a couple more episodes at the end of the workday. So, yeah. And it's based on a book that was very, very popular in Australia about 5 or 6 years ago. So that's my recommendation.
So I saw it on my Netflix feed and so watched the preview, went, not so sure about that. But now you've given it the recommendation, maybe that we'll add that to the watch list.
It's very Australian. Like, it's and it's got a lot of Australian lingo and slang. And so I don't know if it's going to translate to international audiences, but that is my recommendation. And next question. I know you shared some really correct but brutal career advice last time. Do you have any more truth bombs career-wise you'd like to share with the audience?
Nuggets of wisdom as a pithy sage or something. I was a bit brutal last time, and it wasn't any sort of cruel to be kind, but I was thinking about this earlier on when I was remembering we got this recording coming up. So don't pigeonhole yourself. Your resume should not speak to a single job title or role, unless you're a doctor or police officer or fire brigade person or something. But even then, you have a diversity of skills. If you simply say, for instance, I'm an agile coach, you're pigeonholed into what the recruiter's perception or the hiring manager's perception of what that title does as a job. And given the industry's having some challenges now, giving yourself this sort of single title says, this is all this person is. It doesn't say more about this person. And the problem with LinkedIn, we may have covered this last time when we mentioned this, but LinkedIn's a primary source of jobs or job recruitment in the USA. Yep. Most recruiters I work with use LinkedIn for a quick search to see who's available, probably in Oz as well.
Same.
But the problem is they use the profile heading. So you've got your name, like Nigel Thurlow, and then beneath that, you've got all these little nuggets of what you are.
Yeah, so it's either the full alphabet or and lots of.
And the thing is, if you put dad of three in the headline, you know, super duper guy or super duper lady or girl or whatever, nobody's looking for that. Nobody's going to do a search on LinkedIn for a dad of three who's an awesome soccer coach. Yeah. And they may be absolutely true, but that's not how you fill a job requisition. Mm. So make sure you describe what you're looking for in that headline. And that's important, not just to say what you are or who you are or what you do now, but what are you actually looking for? So when people search for those roles, you come up. So if you're a change manager as well as an agile coach, for goodness sake, and you want to be a change manager, put change manager at the front, the first thing. So when they search that, it comes up. Yeah. But if you have other skills and other talents other than, say, pole dancing, then this is where you need to make sure they're placed using the searchable terms. Now, there's nothing wrong with pole dancing, but that's probably not what you want to put on LinkedIn, along with dad of three, mom of four, or, you know. And then the other problem is people are using these eclectic terms as well, like thinker or change maker, or even one person, let's just call him a person in Europe, I'm not a big fan of, calls himself a management exorcist.
The ninja is another one.
Oh, yeah, you know. process ninja. Trust me, no recruiter anywhere on the planet is typing process ninja into a job search engine to find you. It's just not a thing. And there is a consultant, as I say, who calls himself a management exorcist. And I can guarantee you no companies are profiling management exorcists. It's just not what's going to do. So that's my additional nugget of wisdom. Don't pigeonhole yourself. Look at the diversity of skills, knowledge, ability you've got. Make sure that's coming across in your resume, in your LinkedIn and online profiles, and make sure you're making visible what it is you actually want to achieve versus just what you are now. And I would avoid just letting people think all you are a product owner, scrum master, or agile coach, given the current state of the agile job market.
Yep, that's great advice. What's in your LinkedIn headline, Nigel? Do you remember? Should I look it up?
You probably have to look it up. Executive coach is probably there. And then there are a number of other words that might be relevant to the types of services that I'm offering. I'm fortunate is that I'm not looking for a job and I'm not searching. So if you are one of those fortunate people and just want to make a statement about who you are versus what you want to be or what job you want, then put what the hell you like in there. You know, astrologist would be a perfectly good thing to put in there, or, you know, watcher of the universe, or, you know, a time traveler. They're all great things you could describe yourself as, but they're not going to get you a job. Now, fortunately for me, most people tend to look at my LinkedIn profile when they've actually decided they're going to hire me as a consultant. And then they will actually want to look and see what I'm saying on social media. Yeah. So I'm a little bit of a different profile.
I looked you up. Executive coach, board advisor, interim executive, and then co-creator of, I'm assuming that's going to say the flow system. I have to expand on
that. That is correct. Yeah. So there's a couple of things there, because I have some clients that retain me. I'm on a retainer basis. So that's like a fractional executive. So I will be an advisor who operates as an executive for the company, but on a fractional basis or part-time basis. So that sort of conveys that. I am on two or three boards as an advisor, some of them unpaid, so that's sort of speaking to what I actually do, but it's also speaking to what I'm wanting to do. I'm wanting to provide advice and guidance to various people. Sometimes it's the University of North Texas, which I work with. Other times it's actual boards at company level, and normally they are a paid position. So I'm sort of appealing to what I am, but also what I want out there. And the thing like co-creator of the flow system, nobody's ever going to search for the co-creator of the flow system. But if they are viewing my profile, that's then informational so that they can see more about me. Yeah, exactly. But for those that are looking for work, those first one or two words that you're using or one or two phrases you're using really need to speak to what it is you're looking for as a professional and who you are as a professional. So we get an instant one sentence profile of that person.
Yeah. Mine is change management consultant, and then I've got strategy execution, and I think the third one is podcast host, but podcast host doesn't get me jobs, but that is a thing I do. The change management consultant is the one that is the most searched and probably the most applicable. Anyway.
And that's the thing you want.
Yeah.
So that's why you say that. But unfortunately, if you're finding that the jobs you're looking for aren't there anymore, putting agile coach and scrum master isn't really going to be much use. They are things you know, but what is it you're going to go after if those jobs aren't now available or the market's sort of evolving and changing as we cross the chasm or plunge into the chasm even?
So let's talk about that. Maybe starting, we won't get right into that part of it, but maybe we can start with asking, what is fake agile? I'm using air quotes, fake agile. How does it harm agile?
So I thought about this a lot, and it's not just agile, but that's our focus. We will cover that. We could replace the word with whatever favorite chosen word you want, but yes, agile is a major issue. Fake agile, or your chosen word in air quotes, is when we give the appearance of following a way of working while continuing to work as we did before, or simply ignoring the teaching and guidance of the way of working we are purporting to follow. And I actually wrote that down because I thought this giving the appearance of following a way of working while continuing to work as we did before, the status quo, I think is a nice definition. And I read a cartoon the other day, you know, one of the things that popped up on a LinkedIn feed or otherwise, that sort of sums it up. Because I do a lot on the continuous improvement space, and that's probably something we'll dig into a little bit more in this conversation. But it's, and somebody had written this cartoon, the culture of continuous appearance versus a culture of continuous improvement. So we're keeping up the appearance. We're making it look like we're doing this thing, but we're not. It just looks good because we've got all the titles. We're all sitting in small teams. We've all got signs above our desk that have some cool team name on them, or the digital or electronic remote version of that nowadays. We use the language, we use the vocabulary of agile or lean or flow or whatever your favorite words are, but we don't live them or change how we act and behave to achieve the agile or lean, et cetera, outcomes. And there's all there's also the thinking that these agile approaches are just for techies, the folks who write code or work in AI or the digital space, the software developers, when in fact these ways of working are meant to be enterprise-wide. I was having a conversation with somebody from the lean world today about that, and he asked me to define TPS. Because when people look at the Toyota production system, they all think manufacturing. But I think enterprise-wide approach, which encompasses sales and marketing and all the other discrete things, procurement, vendor management, legal, finance, all those sorts of things that are encompassed by this. But most people, when they say agile, they think techies. They don't think enterprise-wide, which is another challenge for them. And then there's the difference between agile ways of working and achieving business agility and the use of specific approaches such as Scrum, which was primarily designed for small teams to develop software, but since has been lauded as a problem-solving technique for all complex problems of the world, that's just wrong. I mean, that's just not correct. And whilst Scrum has applications beyond just plain old software development, it isn't this universal solution for solving world hunger and creating world peace and solving climate change, etc. So that's really the fake agile, purporting to follow a way of working or giving the appearance of following a way of working while continuing to work as we did before. No change happens, just the job titles and the visuals.
And we give the illusion of doing things differently, but we don't. So what I want to say about that is I have been in many organizations that claim to be agile, and in practice they are not. But what has happened is, and this happened to me, the very first exposure I had with Agile many years ago, I thought Agile's stupid. It doesn't make sense. And I don't think it's going to catch on. But what I later realized is it wasn't Agile that was the problem. It was just poor business acumen and people, you know, like and a lot of people go into this, you know, experience thinking, and they get told by everyone, Agile's the way of the future because so many people evangelize it. And then they have a bad experience and they blame Agile, but they don't blame the culture of the company or the conditions. And it's actually not Agile's fault because it's not being executed correctly. But then it gets unfairly blamed for all of these, you know, lack of outcomes and frustrations and business problems. So one example of my very first experience, you know, people weren't able to give timelines on when they would produce things, and they weren't able to provide really much documentation. We were kind of at this vendor's whims. And I realized that, and they said, oh, it's because we're agile, right? So that's a really common one that people get is, I don't have to be answerable to you, the client, or provide any sort of, you know, timelines or documentation, which isn't really true. And so people think, well, agile, you know, we can't work that way.
And you know, the thing is, when you ask people what do they mean by we're an agile company or we're agile, they struggle to actually, you know, describe that in a way that makes sense. And to me, when I talk about business agility, it's the ability for an organization, a company, a business to change direction rapidly, to make decisions quickly, to implement those decisions quickly. And that's typically in, you know, as a consequence of some external force or trigger or event, you know, world politics, war, financial issues, you know, inflationary trends, competition, all those sort of factors. How fast can you respond? How fast can you make decisions? I teach something called bias towards action, which is, you know, making the right decisions, better decisions, and making them rapidly so you can pivot, you can change direction. And if you break that all the way down to the product level, it's how fast you can change direction on the product or service to meet customer expectations teams at a team level? How willing are you how able are you to respond to changes that are coming in, these emergent requirements and feedback you're getting at an individual level? How willing are you to change and be adaptable in your way, your behavior, your support of the team, the way you act? But when you ask somebody to describe Agile to you, they sort of cite the manifesto or point at Scrum. And I can tell you now, being an Agile company is nothing to do with using Scrum. Yeah. And you don't need Scrum to be Agile. You don't actually need the Agile manifesto to be Agile. Yeah. In fact, you need nothing to do with the Agile movement to be Agile.
Yeah.
But that's where this thing's got derailed and a bit confused.
Yeah. And there's also almost been some gatekeeping of Agile, you know, by certain people. And I'll give an example that I'd say to change managers all the time, because what's happening in change is the dominant, and similar to, you know, software building and project delivery, the dominant change management methodologies are waterfall. And we're now in a world where organizations are agile and change is happening in an agile way. So change management practitioners need to upskill themselves on agile ways of working and know how to do change and, you know, be a change agent and lead and deliver change and support their leaders to deliver change in an agile way. So that's something that's very topical in our world.
Wow.
And now,
and that's funny, because I'm just going to add to that, because what you were describing, and if we take that back down to that fundamental principles, that lean thinking principles I was talking about when you were asking me about what I'm reading, that's small batch production.
Yeah.
So when we sort of, and we can replace the word with production with the word work, if you like. So we are basically breaking things down into small batches that we can process rapidly, learn from doing that processing, and make rapid decisions about, are we going in the right direction? Do we need to change direction and move in a different direction?
Yes.
And we can make those decisions quickly. That's all it boils down to.
Yes. And what I say to change managers, because a lot of change managers are scared and they have a bit of trepidation and they say, well, I'm not agile. I don't know anything about Agile. And I'm like, you are. I say, when did you ever write a comms plan or a change plan? And you wrote out all the different types of comms you were going to do for this change. And when did you stick to it to the letter? You didn't, because you send something out or you have an executive deliver a message and you go, that didn't really land. Maybe it needs to come from someone else, or maybe it needs to be a face-to-face verbal communication instead of written communication. So you change your approach based on what you learn. That's, you know, being agile, right? And so I always say to change managers, you're actually a lot more agile than you think. Change managers are always begging people to do a pilot rather than a big bang go live, right? Because you want to minimize your risk. You want to go live to a small amount of people and make changes based on what you learn. So while you may not be describing those actions as agile, really, you're still following the principles. So I always say that to change, because it's not about I'm Scrum certified, therefore I'm allowed to, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we do inherently that is agile.
You know, you've just given a great reason why people should go straight to the resumes and their LinkedIn profiles and put change manager or, you know, in there, because you've just created a competition for yourself. Because
I'll get to that in a minute, because that is happening. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's basically what we're doing. We're enabling change management with an organization, or the management of change. And the way you just described the agility is a fantastic way to describe that to executives and to people who are burned out with the agile echo chamber or don't really understand what it truly meant. You've just described that. And I would urge your listeners of this podcast to go snip that clip and transcribe it and use that repeatedly.
Yeah. Yeah. Because a lot of what we do as change practitioners is agile by nature. We just don't know it. So I'd say to change people, don't dog yourself. Like, don't say, oh, because, and often, you know, change people get told you're not agile by agilists, because and this is another massive bugbear of mine. It's not my personal therapy session, but one thing that really grinds my gears about change is it's not included in PMBOK and PRINCE2 and, you know, and it's also not included in some of the major agile methodologies. So when people go away and they do their Scrum, you know, they don't talk about change management. So therefore, sometimes people think there's not a place for us in organizations. And that's a whole other podcast episode, because obviously I think there is, but I'm also biased. But it's like, no matter what you call it, whether it's an agile change agent or change manager, somebody is responsible for making sure that the change goes well. Did we get our return on investment? Did we achieve what we set out to achieve? Are we realizing our benefits? Anyway, I'm going way off topic, so I'm going to bring myself back. I want to ask you, what is a bullshit job?
So I know we covered this briefly last time we met, and this is why we came back together, because I went off in a whole different direction last time, which was probably reasonably interesting, I hope. But
it was.
So I'm going to give you the quoted definition from the work by Professor David Graeber, unfortunately no longer with us, passed away in, I think, 2020. But he wrote the original book entitled Bullshit Jobs, based upon a bunch of papers I think he'd written for Harvard and others. And the book was published in 2018. And that's where my inspiration came from for the talk I gave last year in Lisbon in Portugal. But this is his definition: a form of paid employment that is so completely pointless, unnecessary, or pernicious, meaning harmful in some way, that even the employee cannot justify its existence, even though as part of the conditions of employment, the employee feels obliged to pretend that this is not the case. So David then went on to describe bullshit jobs in five categories. I'm going to give you those, and I wrote them down because it was easier, although there's probably more that your listeners could define. These were his at the time, and because I'm speaking to an Australian audience predominantly here, the British English, the Australian English, and some of this will translate instantly. It's not so easy in other languages to translate. So his first job title was flunkies. They serve to make their superiors feel important by being subordinate and groveling in some way and doing whatever they're told to do. Then he talked about goons, or I would say heavies, that are hired due to a dynamic of one-upmanship to compete with our rivals. So they're finding all the ways to undermine our rivals and to do them down. And you see that, hey, that's all over American politics nowadays. So if you want to know what a goon is, go watch the American election campaigning. And then these duct tapers, you know, the duct tape we get, and who temporarily fix problems that could be fixed permanently. Mm. You only have to look at people who repair roads to understand what a duct taper is.
Yeah.
And then you've got the box tickers, most of us will be familiar with, who only create the appearance that something useful is being done. So I wrote some notes here. Endless stage gates and compliance and approvals would go here. So they're your box tickers, endless charts of things you have to comply with. And then taskmasters. And we've all worked for taskmasters to manage or create more work for workers who don't need it. So a lot of managers do this.
Yeah.
I added another one, which is something that I've talked about a lot in my previous work. And I didn't invent this. It's just something I've used in a lot of my material. The hero, those people who always save the day and make themselves indispensable. And they're in fact a cost to the companies. They become the bottleneck of business process because they alone can handle their work or that work. They do not develop people who report to them because that would be a threat to them. Mm. And heroes expose businesses to risk because heroes are often the sole source for that deep tribal knowledge. So a bullshit job is one where the definition of the job or role is designed for appearances and not for function. So the current flavor of the month requires this particular job role and said definition, but the function is impossible to carry out unless we change how we do what we do. But we're not prepared to change how we do what we do, but we must have the roles as defined by Scrum or Agile or XYZ approach or methodology to maintain that sort of semblance or appearance of following the approach, framework, or methodology. And then there's SAFe, the Scaled Agile Framework.
Very popular in Australia. Very popular.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. One of my clients told me last week that SAFe don't understand value streams. And while they use some of the constructs from SAFe, like release trains, which were not a SAFe invention, by the way, like predated SAFe, that they use different approaches and techniques because SAFe don't get certain things right. And value streams, I would also support that they don't truly understand. But the challenge with SAFe, they relabeled a lot of the status quo. So these new titles like release train engineer means program manager. Well, then call it a program manager because that's basically what they do. And a scrum master ends up being a delivery manager because you've got 10 or 12 weeks of your PI planning that's been done. And it's not like every 2 weeks you are going to stop and review the results and decide whether or not all the planning you did 2 weeks before and your 2.5 days of PI planning now needs to be changed because of emergent learning. So the Scrum Master's job is just to make sure that each scrum gets done and that type of thing. Now, I may be being disingenuous to a few people who are really good Scrum Masters in safe environments, but that's the type of thing we're talking about. And for those that are now screaming back at this podcast and throwing the proverbial at whatever they're listening to it on, because you're in one of those roles, just ask yourself this: how much ability do you have to actually change what is being done or how it is being done? Yep. Now, if you're one of those fortunate Scrum Masters or coaches that actually coach a team or team of teams or coach the organization, then count yourself amongst the lucky and the few that are avoiding the mass culling in the Agile and Scrum worlds of all these roles that have become pointless or pernicious. Because guess what? Why are they firing all these Scrum Masters and Agile coaches? Mm. In the US at the moment, it's a mass culling. And I saw a post in one of my Slack channels I'm a member of as a Scrum trainer. They're finding that certain job ads for Scrum Masters are getting 100 applications per hour.
Wow.
Per hour for one role. So that tells you that they've cut all these roles, and you've got to ask yourself, why did they cut all these roles?
Yeah.
And because of some of the things we've been describing earlier on, it's because these roles were not able to function as they were designed to function and became, unfortunately, what I, you know, termed for a bit of fun as a bullshit job. And Professor Graeber really outlined in his work.
Yeah. And I think as well, when companies are looking to make cuts, they do look at what they perceive as the value add to the organization, and anything that's not really involved in the day-to-day running, aka how the organization makes money, will be looked at very closely, like any sort of support. And change management is also one of those functions. So change is often the first to get cut. And I will say, I have had experiences where I took some notes while you were talking, where I have been forced into a box ticker role, or I have been forced into a duct tape role, because you also talked about fake agile and, you know, giving the illusion of being something you're not. And there's fake transformation, right? So that's incremental change dressed up as transformation. And I've been brought on for this big fancy transformation, and I'm not really enabling true change. I'm just doing some incremental stuff. And there's also some organizations, and I'm thinking in Australia, banks and government departments are probably the most guilty of this, that are so stage gate and compliance heavy, that in order to move to the next stage gate, or, you know, get your business case approved, you must complete all of these templated deliverables. And so whether you know, no matter what your role is in the change team, whether you're a change manager or a program manager, you must complete them. And so that's the work that you do, is completing template, which I kind of call change by numbers, because you're really just, you know, ticking the boxes, and you're usually being ordered around by a taskmaster saying, you haven't done a change strategy. Where's my huge stakeholder matrix spreadsheet that takes weeks to complete? Like, that doesn't add value. Like, that's not a value add activity. So yeah, I think change management is very guilty of that. And
you know, it's interesting because Professor Graeber's work, a lot of it was looking at social issues and socialism and that type of thing. But also he looked at governments and the types of companies that you mentioned. When you talk about banks, finance companies, insurance companies, they all function like governments, and I've worked in all of the above over the years, and yes, a lot of those roles exist to do the things that you just described very eloquently and well, and that Professor Graeber talked about. And unfortunately, I mean, I was talking to a client the other week about compliance as code. We've had the ability to run compliance as code. We've got script languages now that allow you to ensure that people can ensure they've met compliance without having to go through all these onerous processes. Mm. The problem is the owners of these onerous processes need them to justify their own existence. Yeah. So now we've become pointless and pernicious. We've just defined a bullshit job, as Professor Graeber's work defined it, by the fact that these people exist to only continue to exist. They're sustaining their own survival.
Yeah, and they're just cogs in the machine. And anyone who is in change or agile who says that that hasn't happened to them is a liar, I reckon.
Yeah, and I've got all these compliance people and people now swearing and cursing and saying this guy's an idiot. But, you know, but the reality of it is, if you are in those roles, how do you eliminate the need for you to be a delay, a constraint, a bottleneck? How do you ensure we have the right processes in place, but now we use the correct tooling, be it compliance as code or other techniques, to eliminate the bottleneck, to improve the flow of value through the system, and that you are no longer there just to cause a delay, or the presence of you there is causing a delay? How do you eliminate that? How do you focus on Kaizen, continuous improvement, to improve what you do? And if you are that type of person that is focusing on improvement, fantastic. If you're the type of person that just says, well, this is necessary, we have to do these things, and you will follow the process because it's
always
then,
done things,
you know,
here.
Sorry, I'll say bullshit to that because you're in a bullshit job.
Yep. Great. So if you have realized you have a bullshit job, which you may have after that little chat, what should you do? Like, how do you de-bullshit your career and your work life?
So take a shower. But after that... After that, let's go back to the earlier career advice. You're not an agile coach or a scrum master. You're not. You are a very talented person with a wide diversity of knowledge, skills, and ability. Care say knowledge, skills, and ability, as they call it. What were you before you wandered into this world of Willy Wonka? How do you explain that? I mean, before this agile thing was a thing, I mean, it'd been around since the sort of 90s with XP and the Scrum folks, and then became a thing with the manifesto in 2001. Well, what were you doing before that happened, assuming you're as old as me, which is as old as the hills? Or have you always been a Scrum person? Is that all you've ever known? You were born to be a Scrum person. But what were you before, or what other things have you learned to do other than just those two job titles? Review and rewrite your resume. Describe who you are. A person who has a wide array of experiences and proven skills, who just happens to know Scrum or some agile stuff. So their skills you have, they're not defining who you are. That's one of the critical things in the way you sell yourself. And remember, a resume is just a sales document to get you an interview. After that, it's all about you, the person, your skills, knowledge, your personality, and everything else. So go sell that and look for real jobs that value that cognitive diversity. If you're in a bullshit job, first reevaluate your work life. So first of all, you know, can you be effective in that role?
Yeah.
Can you influence change to enable that role or similar roles and ways of working?
Yeah.
Is it pointless and pernicious? Is it sapping your will to live? Is it draining the life force from you?
Yeah.
Because if you're in a role that you can't be effective in, or you can't affect change within the organization, or affect change in the role that you're performing within the organization, then it's probably time to think about moving to another role, if one exists. Appreciate the job market can be tough.
Yeah.
But
do
if
you actually like it? Because I think some people actually like having everything spelled out for them and like being told what to do. And that's okay too, because I know there is, I worked a few years ago for a large insurer, and I was working on a merger because they bought another insurance company off one of the country's biggest banks. Big project. It was so fun. And some of the people in their internal change team, because like you said, a lot of people, like, nobody grows up thinking, I want to be a change manager. I want to be I want to help organizations lead change. You do another job. In my case, it was business analyst. And you fall into it. So a lot of people who work in organizations, they end up doing change management because they had some sort of, you know, business operational subject matter expert role, and they get seconded into a project as an SME, and then they end up in change. And so there were a lot of people in that organization in change, and they were struggling because there wasn't a SharePoint they could go to that had outlined, this is what you do at this phase and this is what you do at that phase. And they were really, and I tried to help as much as I could, but I personally prefer that because I don't think I could go to the large bank where I must do this and only this, and it has to be the template in this format. And I can't, you know, I can't go, oh, maybe I'll do this type of change canvas that I developed for this client. I think that would work really well here. No. And so I prefer to stay in environments where, and because I've been in those environments, I've been able to experiment and invent my own stuff, which is now my own IP. And I've had all these great opportunities, but not everybody wants to. And yeah, I know there's one bank in particular in Australia that is really well known for turning out change professionals who can't actually do change management.
Because interesting. I do know one of the banks there, but I won't mention the name because I do have a friend that works there, and that would be really bad and terrible. Yeah. But so just to your point, there are people. So we're talking predominantly in this conversation about the agile space and people in those change roles, be it lean, be it agile, be it something else. But there are people out there, you are absolutely right, who are happy to do a job. They don't want a particular career, or they don't want to change the world or change an organization or do anything to do with change. They're happy to fulfill a extremely valuable service within the role they do, whether it's front of house, back of house, whatever that happens to be. And there's nothing wrong in that. The one other thing that Graeber talks about is that, you know, and I've mentioned this before in other conversations, the people who do the most mundane tasks and often the lowest paid tasks are the most important people out there. And what Graeber said in his work before, if you woke, and it says it in the book, Bullshit Jobs, and I really do, it's so cheap, go buy it, get it on Kindle or whatever and read it. But if you woke up tomorrow morning and all the managers and all the directors and all the executives had disappeared, nobody would notice. But if you woke up tomorrow morning and found everybody who serves your coffee, serves your meals and looks after the patients in hospitals and all that sort of thing disappeared, we'd notice instantaneously. Mm. And that's the reality of this, is that these people are often unseen, unheard, who I try and give a voice to when I go into companies, because they are the people delivering the value. Yeah. I actually have a slide, which, you know, I use a lot, which is, you know, I've got managers telling managers, telling managers that tell managers that tell the people what to do. And I said, where's the value created here and where's the waste? And so that's what we get. But if you are in a job which is a change enabler, a change agent, whatever word you want to use, so a change manager, an agile coach, a scrum master, an agile practitioner of some description, then of course it's relevant for you that if you are unable to effect change, influence change, guide change, then you're probably in the wrong job or working for the wrong organization, because they're hiring you with some pretensity of this idea of being able to do this role. But then once you're in this role, you're just an appearance. You're just you're pretending, you're dressed up in this, you're wearing the badge, but you're not actually making the any difference within the organization. Now, if you're already on, and I apologize for this, the agile scrap heap, then redouble your efforts to reinvent, reimagine, remarket who you are. And I'm talking to a number of, you know, ex-agile coaches or having to do the same. Now, I'm talking about people who were extremely well paid, extremely senior, extremely well versed in the market. We're not talking about junior scrum masters who've just done their first CSM course here. We're talking about people with 10, 20 years of experience that, you know, aren't too old to be employed and are really, really good people.
Yeah. And they've got great networks and very well, highly regarded. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I've got some of those applying back into project management roles, because, you know, good old project management works if you're building things like office blocks and houses and things, you know, because there's a linear sequence in how those things come together. And you're not going to start iterating halfway through the bricklaying, you know, other than the basic emergent problems, you know, and solving problems. But the work is pre-planned, it's predetermined. And there's a lot of roles for project management out there. So and the problem is a lot of these scrum folks never learned traditional project management, and for a lot of them it's an anathema, but hey, it still exists and it's still extremely valid. If you're digging up roads, putting cables in or pipes, plain old project management works quite well. And the other thing is product management. Product, I mean, people have got some product owner skill, product management roles, and product delivery roles. So you've just spent years working in product delivery teams, scrum teams. So you might know a little bit about product management. Now, it won't make you a product manager from a sales and marketing perspective unless you've got deep domain knowledge in that area. But maybe you do have. Maybe you can go and fulfill the role of something like a product owner, product manager, product delivery person. So these are the things you've got to start thinking about. And back to the fact that the pithy bit of advice that you gave earlier, which was extremely salient, which is, you know, hey, we're all change agents, and if there's a market for change management professionals, then I would suggest looking at that and looking at the reinvention of yourself. And by the way, I'm a change management expert who happens to be really knowledgeable about scrum and agile practices, and maybe I know some lean stuff as well, you know.
Yeah, I think in Australia, the advice is definitely because, you know, look at agile delivery, because like you said, there are still a lot of projects happening in Australia. There are a lot of organizations that do operate agile. So that is a skill that a lot of people want, is we want you to be able to manage projects or build software, but do it in an agile way. So I think that's very pertinent advice. And I think if you are an agileist who wants to get into change, send me a DM. My DMs are open if you're looking at that sort of career change and what that might entail. Because yeah, and some people are stepping into change management because they were supporting leaders and executives lead their organization through change. And a lot of what the methodologies when you go and get your certification don't teach you is how to manage change, which is the hardest part. So yes, that was excellent advice. Now, I'm aware we've both got work days to start and finish. So where can people get more, Nigel?
Well, LinkedIn, of course, which is where I normally rant and rave and poke the bear and have a bit of fun, but also post a bit of witticism, hopefully. And nigelthurlow.com, of course, my website, which will give you links to all the other ramblings and ravings. We'll see whether any of that's useful to you.
Do you have any other advice you'd like to share with Casa de Cambio listeners before we wrap up?
You know, one of the things that we may have talked about was the Agile community and stamping out some of this BS that's out there.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's too late. There's people trying to reboot with Agile 2.0 and most of their thinking is fixed and not dissimilar. And you have to ask yourself, why do we need a reboot? Because, you know, do we reboot project management every 3 or 4 or 5 years, I don't know. And, you know, Agile sort of failed, mostly due to the bullshit jobs that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
But also leaders that didn't want to change their behaviors or attitudes and their approaches and stayed in their, dare I say, over-incentivized comfort zones. But maybe not saying that Agile has failed, because that's really just a philosophy, but the attempts to adopt and follow the philosophy have failed. So nothing wrong with the Agile manifesto, the philosophy that's in there, you know, and these sorts of things. And we don't really have a methodology problem. We have a behavior problem.
Yeah.
And we really need to try and get at why executives won't change or can't change.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't know how to change. Maybe they lack the knowledge to change. And where we need to coach and we need to focus is helping those executives to develop the understanding so then they can articulate why the challenge is there to actually changing. But one last comment is, if you're a change agent, how willing are you to change your attitudes, your beliefs, your dogma, your ways of working? Because we're just as bad if we sit here and go, yeah, but there's only one way to do Scrum and it's this way. Well, no, that's not true.
We can be some of the least flexible people out there.
Exactly.
And I have, so I run a masterclass on resistance to change and I talk about how do you counter resistance to change, you know, if it comes up. And one of, and this is based on my real life experiences, because I'm always the person who is sent to the project that is doing badly, because I'm really good at it. So I had to go, well, why am I good at it? But a lot of the time it has involved managing my own project team and my own project, you know, the people who are leading my project, because the way that they've gone about delivering change has really pissed people off and they need to change their approach and they don't want to. Because they are so fixed and they get so mad at other people who they are delivering change to who will not change, but then they won't do it themselves. It's so ironic.
Yeah, my answer to them is go study confirmation bias, because you're probably suffering from it. Because my work is always about learning and understanding, finding new ways of solving challenges, looking at context, looking at what applies at this moment in time within this context. And as time moves on and as context evolves and changes, looking at the methods, the tools, the techniques, approaches, whatever, that we can continue to support and help the direction of travel. And in a complex adaptive system, there is no fixed thinking, because things are evolving and changing all the time. Anything involving humans is a complex adaptive system. So thinking you had a fixed prescriptive way to solve world hunger is unfortunately a fallacy.
Yeah.
So be willing to change yourselves, be adaptive. And if you're not willing to go as we started this conversation, go pick up some of the books on the fundamentals and retrain, reteach, relearn, and understand there are gaps in your knowledge and skills and ability, and fill those in so you can have much more holistic conversations with those that you are trying to influence as a change maker, then you probably need to go and find a different career choice.
Yeah, you absolutely cannot just think you're going to roll out the same templates and processes that work, because it won't work. It will not work.
That's why Agile's failed, or failing, or the implementation of Agile is failing, and the bullshit jobs have arisen because they try to do exactly what you just described.
Mm. All right, we might leave it there.
Tash, this has been fun again.
I know, I could talk to you about this stuff all day, but yes.
I feel like Dr. Carl on the Triple J podcast, you know. Yes, I do listen to that.
I love Dr. Carl. He's a national treasure. He's a everybody loves. Yeah, everyone in Australia absolutely loves. He's one of those people that, like, he's not the most famous celebrity, but everybody knows who he is, and everybody loves him and respects the hell out of him for what he does. And yeah, all right. Well, listeners, that is the end of season 8. We'll be back hopefully later in the year. Nigel, thank you so much for joining me a second time. It's been a blast.
It has indeed. Thank you.